Interviews with Colonel Al Fletcher Prouty, Secrets of the U-2 Flight. We are pleased to announce Volume 1 of Interviews with Colonel Al Fletcher Prouty on DVD. This first one-hour DVD goes through the 1960 U-2 incident with Gary Powers. Colonel Fletcher Prouty reveals his inside knowledge of the incident, his office in the Pentagon, Operation Aquatone, Soviet overflights, and the similar Alan Pope incident. It is Prouty's position that the U-2 flight was sabotaged by the members of a secret team to stop the crusade for peace and embarrass President Eisenhower, thereby heating up the Cold War. And of course, Eisenhower warned everyone of the industrialized military complex that he had learned of firsthand in this incident. You will learn Gary Powers' U-2 never was shot down at 70,000 feet, as claimed in every single history book. Four separate interviews on one DVD, a one-of-a-kind must-have for anyone interested in finding the truth behind the cover story. Interviews with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, Secrets of the U-2 Flight.
Coming up next is the show you've been waiting for, Black Op Radio. You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network.
Studio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for 220K.
T minus 20 seconds. T-minus 15 seconds. T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here are your hosts, Anita Langley and Leno Sanek.
Control, you're on the air.
Yes, we are on the air. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are around the world. This is Black Op Radio coming to you live from a control room here in Vancouver, Canada. I'm joined with my co-host, Anita Langley.
Hello.
And we have on the line, from the west coast of the Americas, USA that is, John Hank. John, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Anita.
Hi.
Hi.
For those who don't recall, John Hankey, he had a wonderful documentary called JFK2, The Bush Connection. He has a new DVD out right now. We're going to talk to him about that for the next hour and a half. I don't think Jim Fetzer will be with us today. He's on the road with his ST-911 movement, and they're very busy. In fact, he didn't get back to me this afternoon, which he usually does, so that tells me he's really busy. So, to get things started, John, if you could give us just a brief background, and listeners, a background of what got you interested in this alternate theory of, not theory, but alternate history, you know, JFK, all these things that people call conspiracies, which actually is just political research, in my mind. If you can give us that background, what got you into it, and we'll talk about your new DVD.
Sure, thanks for having me on. I mean, history has always been my favorite subject. When I was in the sixth grade, I used to have a lot of fun with my teacher discussing history topics, I remember. And in fact, in the seventh grade, my family's German, and I read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich when I was in the seventh grade because I wanted to understand how it was that Hitler could come to power. And it was, you know, it was a mystery to me then, and it's a mystery that I don't think has been adequately explained, how, right, given all of the sore, hard feelings from all of the death inflicted on France and Britain and the U.S. during World War One, how they could have allowed Germany to rearm. So, right, I mean, at that tender age, it occurred to me that the stories that I was getting didn't make sense, but, you know, I was a pretty straight arrow kid and went to school and got good grades. And a friend of mine, when I was 20, brought home something which was at the time illegal. He had a bootleg copy of the Zapruder film showing Kennedy getting his brains blown out the back of the limousine. And I get, you know, this is like, 40 years ago, 30 years ago anyway, and from that time on, I've been pretty much inspired to discover what was really going on in the history of the world, but and very much as one of the focuses, the assassination of John Kennedy. But I can say that I stumbled upon Mark Lane's book, Plausible Denial. This is now about 10 years ago, but it had been out in print for almost 10 years when I stumbled upon it. And, you know, that had a lot of stuff. Pretty much, I think, at the time, it was the definitive work and very much the basis of a lot of the work that I have done. But anyway, I read that, and I thought that I'd come to the end of the line, and I would teach my students about the content of what Lane has to say. And then, I guess, the day that John Jr. died, I was on my way to a conference, and I heard on the radio that his plane was missing. Well, I have 18 years of Catholic education, but I consider myself an atheist in spite of all of what I consider myself. I said a prayer for him and went on about the day's business of studying with other teachers and discussing with other teachers ways to do a better job of doing what we do. I teach high school in East L.A. I taught for 10 years in South Central. East L.A. is the heart of the Chicano community for the last 200 years in Los Angeles. Anyway, I came home and my wife said, hey, let's go out to dinner. We went to my favorite restaurant and we sat down and ordered the food, and I looked up and they had a television that was turned to off. I mean, it was silent. But I looked up and I saw on the muted screen, I saw these boats going back and forth in the water, and I said, oh my God, he's dead. And then Dan Rather came on. And for those in the audience who don't know, the day that John Kennedy Sr. was murdered, of course, there were probably in excess of 2,000 news people by the evening in the city of Dallas, doing all the reporting that they could, and the word got out that there was a moving film of the assassination, and of course they all wanted to see it, and the FBI said, you can't, and they said, what? you killed him, right? I mean, we can't see the video, you must have killed him. And so they made an arrangement, and the arrangement was, they said, we will let one of the reporters who are here assembled see the video, and he will come out and assure you that it says what we're telling you that it says, and Rather was allowed in. And in fact, I think at JFKMurderSolved.com and a number of other sites, you can hear Rather's voice as he comes out and says that the president's head clearly jerked forward. So I look up on the screen, and there's Dan Rather. And I said, oh, my God, not only is he dead, they killed him. And I had sort of an epiphany at that point, a really powerful and sickening insight, because when they killed John Kennedy Sr., they then went rapidly on and in short order killed Malcolm X and killed Martin Luther King and killed dozens of Black Panthers and any number of other opponents of the war in Vietnam. And then they went to Southeast Asia and killed 2 million people and 53,000 veterans and you know, hundreds of thousands of veterans permanently scarred physically and psychologically. And I saw that this was the opening shot in something, and, you know, now we have 9/11, right? And unfortunately, that horrific vision that I had that night has come to fruition. But I don't want to say that I formally dedicated myself, but in fact, everything in my guts forced me to stop doing anything else that I was doing and to pursue the matter of finding out how John Kennedy was murdered, and being able to develop the evidence in a way that would, you know, be credible and believable and understandable to people. And it very quickly became evident that he was killed, and we'll get into some of that in a minute. Just all sorts of, I mean, the Boston Globe, a few days after his murder, published an article that contains a whole lot of the basis for what I present in my video. A lot of that information was available early, showing that there was foul play. But I couldn't begin to imagine who would want to kill John Kennedy. And one day I woke up and my subconscious was screaming at me, the father killed the father, the son killed the son. And I picked that up and started pursuing it. In Mark Lane's book, he presents the Hoover memo, the notorious Hoover memo written, I think, 3 days after the assassination. The title of the memo is Assassination of John F. Kennedy. And then you read the memo, and it doesn't seem to have anything to do with John Kennedy. It's about these CIA, Hoover calls them misguided anti-Castro Cubans. And, of course, there has been an enormous amount written about the involvement of the CIA's anti-Castro Cubans in the assassination of John Kennedy. There's an enormous amount of evidence. E. Howard Hunt, the head of the Watergate burglars, well, the Watergate burglars were all part of this anti-Castro Cuban team. Hunt, when he was sitting in jail, said that they were assassins. And later on, Spotlight magazine published an article in which they said that the author of the article said that he had seen a CIA memo that said, written from either Angleton to Helms, Angleton the assistant to Helms the director, or from Helms the director to Angleton, saying Hunt was in Dallas, he's going to be linked to the assassination. Effectively, not just by rumor, but he is going to be effectively linked to the assassination. What are we going to do? And the response, well, we'll just say that he was a loose cannon. We weren't supervising his activities down there, but acknowledging the fact that Hunt was involved in the assassination. In this memo that Hoover wrote discussing these misguided anti-Castro Cubans, it includes the information that the FBI gave a report to the CIA, to those parties responsible at the CIA for the supervision of those misguided anti-Castro Cubans, and he names George Bush. And, I mean, we can go into this. This is all contained in the video JFK to the Bush Connection, but the point that I was trying to make is that it rapidly became clear to me that in order to understand the murder of John Kennedy Jr., you had to understand the murder of John Kennedy Sr., and that once you understood the very, very hands-on, integral role played by George Bush Sr. in the murder of John Kennedy Sr., once you understood that by participating in the murder of John Kennedy Sr., that George Bush Sr. became a made man, that's a mafia expression. He earned his bone. That's another mafia expression. But that his political career was made, and it didn't matter how many times he lost. And he lost almost every time he ran for anything, when you look at the history of it. And every time that he lost, they would pick him up and dust him off and set him back into a position of power. He ran for Senate twice and lost, and they picked him up and dusted him off and gave him, they made him the Republican nominee in a district that was very solidly Republican, so that he couldn't, right? How are you going to lose that election? This was in Texas. And he lost to Ronald Reagan. Well, they made him, they forced him upon Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan had attacked Bush very viciously for being a tool of the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Trilateral Commission. But as soon as Reagan won the nomination, it was forced upon him that he should take Bush as his vice president. And there's this fabulous book online, the Unauthorized Biography of George Bush, that lays out very, very, very clearly that Reagan was asleep during most of the really terrible things that occurred during his administration, and that George Bush Sr. was the supervisor of the Iran-Contra affair, that he was Oliver North, who supervised the crack epidemic in this country, was working out of the offices of George Bush. The supervisor of the Iran-Contra mess, Felix Rodriguez, when Hassanfuss, a pilot for that operation, got shot down, his first call is to the office of Vice President George Bush. So anyhow, Sr. is an extremely nefarious character, but his political career was established by his entry into politics as his involvement in the assassination of John Kennedy Sr. I'm going to run with that just another couple of minutes. Bush was confronted with this evidence when he was running for re-election, and he lost to Clinton. He was confronted with this evidence of this memo by J. Edgar Hoover naming him as a CIA officer. And he didn't have the assassination thrown in his face, but he did have the fact that apparently he was CIA and wasn't telling anybody when he was a congressman and when he was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and on and on and on, until he was mysteriously appointed as the head of the CIA one day, and many people scratched their heads and said, how is it that this happened? Anyway, Bush said that wasn't him. It must have been another George Bush. But this is all very well documented in my DVD JFK to the Bush Connection.
If I could just jump in here, that one has particularly irritated me over time, that he can just brush and the whole thing just goes away because he says that must be a different George Bush. Hello. I know there is more than one George Bush. One of them is your son, and there's another one by the name of George M. Bush who's involved in running drugs, but hey, we don't want to talk about that. But I'll tell you what, this guy, sleazy as he is, head of the CIA, you don't get to be head of the CIA unless you've done your time.
You have to have some kind of background.
Sure. I mean, and to just suggest that he just came out of the blue. And, of course, most people who've done any research on this know about the ships he had named. This was something Colonel Prouty brought our attention to early, that he had ships that were operating around the Bay of Pigs stuff. So he is traceable. The fact that it takes alternative media persons such as yourself, and by the way, I just have to also say, you did a wonderful job of tracking down all those news clips and stuff for the latest one you did on Junior. I just was blown away at your thoroughness.
Well, thanks, and we'll get into that in just one second, I promise. I wanted to say, though, that, I mean, this is, I don't consider myself, I know how stupid I am, right? And I don't really have any background in investigative anything. So this stuff, if I could do it, it must have been fairly easily at hand. All of this evidence. When George Bush Sr. was at Yale, he was in Skull and Bones. And when he was at Yale in Skull and Bones, he was a brother under the skin to F. Truby Davison, who is the son of the head of recruiting for the CIA. Well, you couldn't possibly have a better in for being in the CIA. And that's only the beginning of it, because when he left Skull and Bones, the minute that he left Skull and Bones, he went to work for a guy who is identified by his father, Prescott Bush, the father of Bush Sr., wrote a letter identifying, and the name is escaping me at the moment, but it's not all that crucial. He was an oil man that Bush went to work for, and Prescott Bush identifies this guy as a recruiter for the CIA. So Bush leaves, and he goes, and he works for this recruiter for the CIA, and then the CIA is getting ready to launch the Bay of Pigs operation. Prescott Bush is working for Harriman. The number two guy at CIA, and I apologize for not having gone over all of these notes, but the number two guy at CIA was not working at CIA at the time. He was working in Harriman's office with Prescott Bush, and he left, joined the CIA, head of operations, and went to supervise operations in the Bay of Pigs. The E. Howard Hunt was working for Harriman, and he left working for Harriman and went to the Caribbean to supervise CIA operations for the invasion of the Bay of Pigs. And George Bush Jr. was working for the CIA recruiter, and at exactly the same time, he went up and set himself up in business in the Caribbean in the middle of CIA operations. It is absolutely implausible that he was not involved, right? He has all of these connections to all of these people who are all moving at the same time into the Caribbean to supervise the CIA's invasion. And then, as you mentioned, his name shows up. Bush had a habit of naming. He named his planes, he was in World War II. He named three of his planes after his wife, the Barbara. The Barbara, I guess it was just two, the Barbara 1 and the Barbara 2. And one of these ships was renamed. Prouty details this, that it was renamed the Barbara. One of them was renamed the Houston, which is where his company was operating. But the code name for the Bay of Pigs operation was Operation Zapata, and that is the name of Bush's oil company that was working in the area. But as we've just seen, Bush has a habit of naming things in his professional CIA career after things in his personal life. So it all fits a fairly tight picture. And we could go on and on. I mean, Bush
was... Yeah, well, you mentioned Operation Zapata. I mean, you know, that's it, right? And you mentioned Colonel Prouty. If anybody's more interested in that, I detail that kind of stuff in everything Colonel Prouty has written on his CD-ROM. Anybody interested in Colonel Prouty should pick that up.
The reason that I made JFK2 was so that people other than myself could get the same background and have the same revelation that the father killed the father, the son killed the son, that they could see, know for sure and beyond a reasonable doubt that the father had made his political career by being involved in the assassination of the father, so that then when you come back, and because, I mean, that was one of the first questions that occurred to me is, Why would anybody want to kill JFK Jr.? Well, you now have a couple of motives. One is that the Bushes have a history of killing Kennedys. Two is that the Bushes hate the Kennedys. I mean, obviously, you can apply the second one from the first one. And thirdly, that if you're trying to run for president and you're trying to persuade the richest, most powerful, most evil people in the country and on the face of the earth, that you have to prove your loyalty by committing a murder, the father had to, why would you not think that the son had to? And if at the very moment that this guy is running for president and needing to demonstrate, right, he's got to earn his bone, he's got to get his ticket punched to get himself a seat at this table, who's he had to have killed someone. We know from, you know, the history of Bush Sr., we know that that's how you get your ticket punched, that's how you get a seat at the table, is by participating in a murder. So the natural question would be, who did George Bush Jr. have to murder in order to earn the loyalty of these guys? But
well,
anyway,
John, if you, let's say you did not subscribe to that point of view, but just that, was John Kennedy Jr. going to become opposition?
No, I mean, I was going to say, let's go on then
and take up
the evidence. I mean, it doesn't even matter, right? It doesn't matter who, what, and where John Kennedy Jr. was. If he wasn't murdered, you can't invent the notion that he was murdered on the basis that he was an enemy of anybody, right? I mean, either there's evidence for a murder or there isn't. But so let's get in and establish the evidence for the murder, and then we'll go on.
Okay.
And discuss who might have wanted to kill him and why. And as I mentioned before, maybe I should, let me take a breath and you guys ask a question if you want to before we jump into this.
I just wanted to confirm then. So your actual reason for doing JFK 2 was motivated by the murder of JFK Jr.
Absolutely, wholly and completely and entirely.
Isn't it interesting, because this has caught my attention, but sometimes it's the most unusual events that cause somebody to take a totally different path. And having seen the first one, I would have thought that you had been researching that for a lot of years and not so recently. Okay, I guess,
but
maybe you have.
But I had gone to sleep.
I see.
Right?
Okay.
Clinton was in the White House, and now I don't want to get everybody screaming at me for saying something good about Clinton, but I was teaching in the inner city of Los Angeles. Definitively, I was at the poorest, most gang-infested school in the city of Los Angeles, and that community was absolutely ruled by the crack trade. A solid third of my students had their home lives absolutely destroyed by the crack trade. Their parents were either involved in it and therefore in prison, or their parents were addicted to crack. It was just incredible, just devastating. The effect of the crack trade on that community. And when Clinton got in, it evaporated. It was gone. And I'm, rightly or wrongly, I'm very, 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 very deeply grateful to him for shutting down the crack trade. It made such, I used to get seriously angry at people who said, oh, Clinton, he cut welfare, blah, 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 blah. Clinton so improved the lives of the poorest people in Los Angeles in a number of other ways, but primarily they reduced the murder rate in Los Angeles by 90%. Shutting down the crack trade reduced the murder rate in Los Angeles by 90%, and there's people who say, oh, MENA airport in Arkansas, I'm sorry, I'm going to get bleeped if I say what I think about that. I think that that was just totally, the only reason for doing that was in order to try to blacken Bill Clinton, in order to keep him from saying anything about the crack trade and Bush's involvement in it, because they would then just be able to say, well, look at MENA, and you can't persuade me that Clinton was involved, given how immediately he shut down the crack trade. And I don't even mean to say that he had to do anything except let the crack traders know that you can't appeal to the president anymore to get off the hook. There's a new sheriff in town, and he doesn't, maybe he knows about what you're doing and he's going to come after you, and maybe he knows about what you're doing and he's not going to come after you, but if you get caught, he is not going to let you off the hook. And it overnight stopped. Anyhow, on to the murder of John Kennedy Jr., yeah. I mentioned earlier that there was a Boston Globe, 2-second paid advertise announcement. My website is JFKII, RomanNumeral2.com, and these videos are available there. They're also available at Amazon if you prefer to do business with Amazon, which is no problem with me anyway.
Yeah, we're going to make a link next to your interview here.
Okay, very good.
For people. But just repeat that for people listening right now.
JFKII, JFK2, Roman numeral 2, JFKRomanNumeral2.com.
Right.
And I guess that's the easiest one, right? If you go to Amazon, you have to know that it's JFK2, the Bush Connection. You have to know that it's The Assassination of John Kennedy Jr. is the title of the other DVD. Anyhow, I mentioned that there was a Boston Globe article that went into the incredible delay involved in launching a rescue, a search and rescue for John Kennedy Jr.'s plane. And it's really great. I mean, the videos on John Kennedy Jr. is 104 minutes. It was originally 200 minutes. I had to do a lot of cutting. But it's sort of inspiring. And you hear people complain about the media all the time. And if you saw the people, the reporters, going after these guys at the Pentagon on this issue of the delay in the rescue, it's inspiring. I mean, the media doesn't suck because the reporters suck. That's not why the media sucks. It's because the editors and the guys who were in charge down there suck. But there's a lot of heroes who are out there as individual reporters. I wanted to say that, and we'll go on. The Pentagon at this news conference is just lying their heads off, and it's one of the best and most powerful things in the video is that you have these, you were saying before, about you have this... the video of the press conference of the Pentagon guys, and they're just caught dead in their tracks in lying, hiding evidence that was available to them in order to keep anyone from going to the search, going to the crash site to conduct a search and rescue for 15 and a half hours. They kept people away.
Okay, John, we got to back up there. You just said 15 and a half hours?
Yes.
There were no
rescue craft sent to the crash site for 15 and one half hours.
Okay, well, let's put things in perspective here. At what time was
The plane crashed at 9:39.
When did he take off?
8:30.
So he took off at 8:30. When was he expected? Around 10?
9:45.
So just 9:45. So
there were people waiting at the airport. At 9:30, they arrived at 9:30, and at 10 o'clock, they began contacting the FAA.
And he made tower contact, which was clearly suppressed from everything that... I was just blown away by that. It was so blatant that they fired the guy who went public with it. So on the one hand, you have the media reporting that that he made contact with the tower, and Pentagon saying...
Anita,
no,
I've
got
to cut you off here. I just want to say, let's put this in a timeline perspective that everyone can follow. He left after 8 o'clock. He's expected at 9:45. At around 9:30 or so, and you mentioned 9:39 or something like that, his plane's gone. So at 10 o'clock then, we're at 10 o'clock in the evening, they make a report, people there waiting for him, that something's wrong.
Yes.
Okay, let's take it from there. We're at 10 o'clock.
Oh, no, we're going to back up again.
Oh, okay, sure.
To this contact with the tower. I mean, when I began investigating this, there were a bunch of... Well, hang on. I'm also going to say that I'm going to pat myself on the back a little bit here. Before I put out JFK2, if you Googled George W. Bush and assassination of John Kennedy, you'd get a handful of hits. And if you do that today, you get thousands and thousands and thousands of hits. This is something that has become very, very well known, the involvement of George H.W. Bush in the assassination of John Kennedy. Anyhow, I started investigating and online, and there was a discussion going on that I think it was CNN reported that the television station had reported that the Coast Guard said that John Kennedy contacted the tower, and managed to get my hands on the actual broadcast from the television station so that you get to hear the guy. His name is Todd Bergen from the Coast Guard, and Todd Bergen tells the people in this videotape that at 9:39 The guy's name is Todd Berg. In 9:39, John Kennedy contacted the tower and said that he was on final approach. Now, the Pentagon says that that's not true. But when you look at the NTS, the 500 pages of the NTSB report, it has a very, very detailed analysis of the last seconds, right? Second, well, in 10, 20, 30-second chunks, it details what his plane was doing, and it details the fact that at 9:39, John Kennedy's plane was 14 miles off the coast. It was holding at 2,500 feet. Well, in fact, it details the fact that the plane dipped down to 2,200 feet and then came back up immediately to 2,500 feet because you're not allowed to go below 2,500 feet without contacting the tower. So that at 9:39 exactly, he, or maybe it's 9:38, he comes back to 2,500 feet and, according to Bergen, contacts the tower, that which is absolutely consistent with what the radar information in the NTSB report shows. So that there's, if Bergen had been off by 1 minute, if he had said 9:37, Kennedy was still descending, he was clearly not on final approach. If he had said 9:40, he would have been wrong. Kennedy clearly didn't contact the tower at 9:40. His plane was plummeting into the water at 9:40. He said 9:39. He was absolutely precise, and there's no way that he could have been correct with that kind of precision unless he was in contact with the people at the tower at Martha's Vineyard getting this information. The point is that there's absolutely no way that he did not, in fact, contact the tower. Now, that gets to be an enormously important point, him contacting the tower, because if you're a pilot and you're in their plane and you contact air traffic control, his plane, and I, for all I know, all planes, but certainly all modern, sophisticated planes, if you buy anything that's close to state-of-the-art, your plane contains what's called a transponder, which means that the radar doesn't just pick you up because you're in the blip. Your plane is emitting a signal. This gets to be an issue with 9/11 as well, but your plane is emitting a signal that gives your identification, it gives your altitude, and it gives your location, so that all of that information is transmitted every couple of seconds by your plane to the FAA radar system. And if your plane descends below 100 feet any place but on the tarmac of your intended airport, it sets off an alarm at the FAA headquarters, so that the FAA knew before Kennedy's plane hit the water that they needed to initiate a search and rescue, that there was a problem. If 15 and a half hours later, they still had not sent any rescue craft to the area that they knew about before the plane hit the water. Anyhow, the...
Well, this is what I find baffling. I'm sitting here thinking it's 10 o'clock. Some people have reported in saying the plane's overdue. And you're saying no one did anything for 15 hours?
Well, we're still back at 9:39. Because Kennedy's plane also had an emergency locator transmitter. All planes are required to have an emergency locator transmitter. ABC. Todd Bergen managed to get in contact with somebody at the FAA who gave him this information about contact with the tower. ABC managed to get in contact with somebody. I mean, everybody in the government isn't crooked. Somebody in the government told ABC that the ELT, the emergency locator transmitter, went off, and they gave them the location, and they put it up on the screen, and it's in the video, it's in the DVD, that you see this emergency locator beacon going off in an ABC graphic, right, explaining this stuff. It went off immediately. It's accurate within a few yards, so that they knew within a few yards instantly. They knew before the plane hit the water there were alarms going off. They knew the instant the plane hit the water because the ELT went off. In addition, he said he was on final approach. FAA regulations require them to begin a search within 5 minutes. If a guy is on final approach and doesn't land, within 5 minutes they're supposed to begin a search. 15 and a half hours. So the family phone calls are interesting, and we're going to get to them right now, but I just wanted to fill in that there is all of this other background as well. So the family starts contacting the family at the airport waiting for them, starts contacting the airport at 10 o'clock. They continue contacting the FAA from 10 o'clock until 11 o'clock, and they're not getting any response from the FAA. At 11 o'clock, they're sufficiently panicked that they bring Senator Kennedy in. 11 o'clock, Senator Kennedy starts contacting the FAA, and he is unable to get them to do anything. Now, this guy's a U.S. senator. You would think that a U.S. senator could get some response from low-level clerks at the FAA, but it's, as far as I'm concerned, I think this is pretty solid evidence that this was a dry run for 9/11. They had to identify the people at FAA who were dependable to, you know, right, to stand down. And for 15 and a half hours, the FAA stood down on July 16th, 1999. And like I said, I think they needed to identify which people they could rely upon to cooperate with them in standing down on September 11th. This was a dry run, and we go forward. The Kennedy family, let me take a breath. Go ahead. Did you want to say something?
Oh, no, that's okay. You're on a roll.
All right. Well, at 11 o'clock, Kennedy Sr. isn't unable to do anything. At 2 a.m., they give up on the FAA, right? We're not going to get the FAA to do anything. And some, you know, resourceful, intelligent person says, well, let's contact the Coast Guard, right? If he crashed, he undoubtedly went into the water. For all I know, the family, they had contacts at the FAA, at the Coast Guard. In any case, they contacted the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard took it all down, and as the Coast Guard routinely does whenever they get such a report, they posted it so that the media could get it. Now, it's really important, I think, to note that these people making this contact with the Coast Guard at 2 o'clock in the morning said that there was a flight instructor on the plane. These are the guys, I mean, who in the family is more involved, who in the family is more knowledgeable about the circumstances than the guys who are up at 2 a.m. trying to get this thing going, and they told the Coast Guard that there was a flight instructor on the plane. In any case, at 6 o'clock in the morning, Senator Kennedy is still up, and he contacts John Podesta at the White House and wakes him up and makes Podesta go in and wake up Clinton. And Clinton says, well, you know, tell those guys at the Air Force that they're all going to be fired if... I left something out. They contacted the Kennedys at 2 a.m. contacted the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard said, okay, and they, like I said, they notify the media, but they also, they did what they normally would do in a situation like this, which is they contacted the FAA. Well, this is a new situation because it's now, right, there's a government agency involved. There are now all sorts of official records established that the family has reported this plane missing, and so the FAA has to do something, and they call up the Air Force, and the Air Force calls up the Coast Guard and says, we're in charge of the search and rescue, and they send them to Long Island. Right, they know that he's on final approach to Martha's Vineyard, which means he's 14 miles at most off the coast of Martha's Vineyard, and they send the Coast Guard to search the waters off of the east end of Long Island.
How far away is that?
About 150 miles.
Wow, that's a big difference.
Yeah, it's a big difference. There may be somebody on the East Coast who's going to question that. I believe it's approximately 150 miles. Anyhow, now, here's a question. What the hell is going on? The Kennedy's plane hit the water at 200 miles an hour. Those people were all dead instantly. Why the hell would they provoke the Kennedy family so outrageously? In fact, there's a couple of things. One is there's this huge provocation of the Kennedys. Nothing about it in the media. I found one article that said that Edward Kennedy was furious that the FAA didn't give any explanation as to why. He was furious at the FAA. One article in the entire, I believe that I read every single relevant article in the United States press. I had somebody who was helping me do that, but they sent me a large packet of Xeroxed articles, and I think I had everything. Anyhow, one article, and it doesn't say why. Why would they provoke the Kennedys in this fashion? What the hell is going on? And I would like the people in your audience to sit there and stew on that question for a second, and then we'll move on, and, you know, they can keep it in the back of their minds. I'm ready to talk about the flight instructor unless you want to ask a question or make a comment.
No, actually, I think the flight instructor is a very curious thing, then maybe we should just move on.
Okay, very good. Well, so I said that the most reputable, the most intelligent, the most involved and resourceful and competent of the Kennedy family reported that there was a flight instructor, and they reported it to the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard reported it to the media. John Kennedy had lunch with his senior editor at George Magazine the afternoon of the day that he died. They went to lunch, and as they're leaving, the guy's name is Richard Blow. He wrote an article in Esquire magazine. He also wrote a book about it. And in both of those sources, he says that as they're walking back, they were discussing the fact that John was going to be flying that evening, and Richard Blow looks at his injured ankle. He had just had the cast taken off. He had broken his foot about a month before, and he had just had the cast taken off, and he looks at his injured foot and says, should you be flying with this broken foot? And Kennedy says, don't worry about it. I'm going to have a flight instructor. So, right, there's another solid piece of evidence that Kennedy had a flight instructor. And here's another one. Kennedy always flew with a flight instructor. In 6 months of investigation, they were unable to find a single witness to an incident of Kennedy flying without a flight instructor. There's a lot of reasons that he often, or in fact, always flew with a flight instructor. One was that he had this new and sophisticated plane. It had this fancy autopilot. He had an autopilot on the plane. He could have pushed a button. It would have taken him to the runway. At the push of a button, the plane could have flown itself to the runway. But it has this sophisticated stuff. Well, you have to learn to use all the sophisticated stuff. Well, there is a report by one of the flight instructors that Kennedy had learned and was very competent at the autopilot. But there are all, a bunch of other things. Secondly, he was working on his instrument license. He had passed the written and he had passed the performance, but he needed to log hours with a flight instructor flying on the instruments in order to get his instrument license. Thirdly, he had this injured foot. Having an injured foot doesn't make it difficult for you to, or incompetent, or in any way harm your ability to fly the plane in the air. But when you're on the ground, you have to use foot pedals in order to steer the plane, and it would have been very, very convenient for John to have somebody who could take over and do the foot pedals for him. It would have been very painful, no doubt, for him to do it otherwise. He could have done it, but it would have been painful. Why would he not have had a flight instructor on the plane? And most importantly, is this final point. John was, every single one of, I think there's 12 statements by 12 different flight instructors in the NTSB report, and all of them stress that John was very cautious, he was very careful, he was very meticulous about following all of the routines. In fact, one of his flight instructors told me that he would have to remind John, hey, relax and enjoy the flight a little bit, because he would be so preoccupied with, paying attention to everything that was going on. In any case, in the month previous to the accident, Kennedy had flown, I believe, seven or eight times to Martha's Vineyard. On five of those flights, he had encountered conditions that were so hazy that they had to fly on instruments. Well, if you don't have an instrument license, it's illegal for you to put yourself into that situation. And as I said, all of his flight instructors said that John would never do anything that was remotely resembled breaking the rules. That it's unanimous that it was very hazy in New York as he was taking off. Five of the previous eight flights, he had needed to have a flight instructor on the plane. It is inconceivable that he would have taken off into that haze without a flight instructor on the plane, given his demeanor and his general behavior in that regard. In fact, conditions were much more clear at Martha's Vineyard. It wasn't hazy. The moon was visible at Martha's Vineyard, but he didn't know that when he was taking off, so there is absolutely no reason to believe that there was not a flight instructor on the plane. Nevertheless, at 1:30 in the afternoon, the Pentagon starts telling various lies, and we just discussed one of them. One of the lies that they said was that he didn't contact the tower. They later told a couple of other fairly obvious lies, that he didn't file a flight plan and that he didn't contact. In fact, they said he didn't contact any of the air control facilities along the route. No flight instructor that John had, you couldn't persuade any of them that that was the case. That would be absolutely unbelievable. At the same time that they're telling those lies, the story comes out in the media. It's in the video. You hear the reporter say that the family said that John didn't have a pilot's license. Well, that's just insanely wrong. He had 300 hours. He had enough hours flying to have a flight instructor's license. But he was a highly skilled and highly trained pilot, and he may have had a license for 17 years or something ridiculous like that. And in any case, at the same time that they're telling all these other lies, they tell the lie that someone in the family says that there was no flight instructor on the plane. And my question to you and your audience is, why would anybody say that there was no flight instructor on the plane when there was absolutely no evidence to back it? And the story then gets pulled unanimously by all of the media. They all jump into lockstep. Oh, suddenly there was no flight instructor on the plane. There were no eyewitnesses to the takeoff. There were no phone calls, according to the NTSB, made after the takeoff. Nobody could know for sure whether or not there was a flight instructor on the plane. There's absolutely no evidence to substantiate, to base a statement that there was no flight instructor on the plane. And then there's all this overwhelming evidence, right? If you don't know, your best guess, that all of the evidence, 100% of the evidence, if you're going to make a guess, says that there was a flight instructor on the plane, where the hell did this story come from? And what, given that it had to have been based on nothing, where did it come from?
Interviews with Colonel Al Fletcher Prouty, Secrets of the U-2 Flight. We are pleased to announce Volume 1 of Interviews with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty on DVD. This first one-hour DVD goes through the 1960 U-2 incident with Gary Powers. Colonel Fletcher Prouty reveals his inside knowledge of the incident, his office in the Pentagon, Operation Aquatone, Soviet overflights, and the similar Alan Pope incident. It is Prouty's position that the U-2 flight was sabotaged by the members of a secret team to stop the crusade for peace and embarrass President Eisenhower, thereby heating up the Cold War. And of course, Eisenhower warned everyone of the industrialized military complex that he had learned of firsthand in this incident. You will learn Gary Powers' U-2 never was shot down at 70,000 feet, as claimed in every single history book. Four separate interviews on one DVD, a one-of-a-kind must-have for anyone interested in finding the truth behind the cover story. Interviews with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, Secrets of the U-2 Flight.
We can now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder. If you believe there's more to the JFK assassination and the mystery surrounding the CIA and its covert operations, you're not alone. Meet the man Oliver Stone called X in the epic motion picture JFK. Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty comes forward with never-before-seen or heard documentation and information about JFK, the Vietnam War, the CIA, and more on a brand new CD-ROM. The collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty is an incredible offer not to be missed. For a limited time only, find the answers surrounding these issues and more with the collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. Call now at area code 604-525-4167. That's area code 604-525-4167. Or visit the Colonel Prouty reference site on the World Wide Web. The collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty.
The Colonel Prouty reference site, www.prouty.org. That's P-R-O-U-T-Y, prouty.org. The Colonel Prouty reference site.
You've enjoyed Black Op Radio live and archived over the web, but now there's a way to listen without having to use valuable internet time. Order the Black Op Radio Archive CD-ROM. No more network congestion or buffering or file not found. The shows play right from your computer off the CD-ROM. Great for research or as a gift. For more details, check the website.